In the episode of Startups for the Rest of Us you are about to hear, Mike and I discuss how to structure your SaaS support team. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 267. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. So word this week, Mike.
You know, as you read the intro, I totally thought you were going to mess it up.
Yeah? No, I that was from memory, too. I didn't even read the doc this time. Unlike at MicroConf Europe, when I was trying to intro the conference and froze in the middle of the intro and you had to pick it up, that was a moment.
Yeah, that was a rather interesting. I thought about just like singing a song or something like that. But yeah, I couldn't then come up with anything good on the spot.
Bailed me out. So what's going on with you?
I talked a little bit about it last week about taking pre-orders for the product I'm working on. And I'm up to 10 pre-orders at the moment. And I've got some more that are going through the decision-making process. And then a few more that need to be scheduled. But I'm thinking about breaking some ground on the code right now and working out what the timeline is exactly going to look like and whether or not everything's going to make it, because that's still a little bit in flux. But things are looking good so far.
Congratulations, man.
Yep. I still need to go through and I want to do in parallel some testing with some, just do some like paid advertising to pull in some cold leads and do a little bit of experimentation to figure out what that marketing plan is going to look like post-launch. But I think I have a good handle on what exactly people are looking for and how to position it.
One piece of advice I'd give is get that landing page up now. Even if you're not going to run ads to it, eventually you're going to mention the domain name here on the show. People are just going to start talking about it. It might show up in Twitter, and you want to be able to send them somewhere and have them be able to enter their email. So if you don't already have that up, I would do that before I touched any code.
Yeah, that's definitely on my list of things to do. And I've been, I wouldn't say pushing it off, but it's definitely been a lower priority just because of all the other things that are going on. So yeah, I recognize that I've got to get that done. And even the people that I've given a demo to have kind of looked over there and said, hey, there's no landing page or anything here. There's a place where they can pre-order, but there's just not really any content there.
Right. And have you already created mock-ups and you feel like the folks who've pre-ordered know what they've pre-ordered? Like it's very locked down?
Yeah, I spent probably, I don't even know, maybe 20 to 25 hours working out the mock-ups and basically building the entire UX for the application and the demo process that I went through with these 10 people who've pre-ordered. I spent probably anywhere from, I think, on the 25 to 30 minutes on the really low end, but the vast majority of them were 45, 50, 60 minutes. I think the longest one was about 2 to 2.5 hours, walking through exactly what it looked like, how it would work, answering any questions that they had, working through different scenarios and things like that. So everyone who's pre-ordered, I believe, has a pretty good idea of exactly what it is that they're getting.
Very cool. So you're just itching to get into the code, aren't you?
Yeah, and that's something I've been holding back on.
Yeah, it's always a good idea to fight that urge as long as possible.
Right.
Because so. once you get into the code, you're like, you just become hyper-focused. And I'm not saying you, just in general, developers, we get sucked in.
Get tunnel vision is really
what
it comes down to.
There you go. There you go. So I have a couple things. One is, if you're listening to this and you didn't know I have another podcast that I record with my wife, I wanted to tell you about it. Episode 45 of our podcast, Zen Founder, seems to be catching some people's eye, and it's about onboarding your spouse. It's about getting your spouse on board with your kind of startup aspirations. And you had recommended to someone via email I saw, and then some other people were emailing and tweeting about it. So if you haven't checked out Zen Founder, it's in iTunes, obviously, zenfounder.com. You might want to start with episode 45 because it seems to have resonated with a lot of folks in the bootstrapper space. The other thing I wanted to mention is if you're not connected with Mike and I on Twitter, come check us out. I'm at Rob Walling and Mike is at Single Founder.
So what are we talking about this week?
So today I wanted to talk about how to structure a support team. I think we're going to focus mostly on SaaS. This would probably apply to any type of downloadable software, membership sites, info products. I mean, they all have similar issues. And I really wanted for us to kind of speak from experience, and I've been making it up as I go along for sure. There are experts in this space. You know, Sarah Hatter has kind of built her career on being a SaaS support expert and has spoken at MicroConf a few times. So she has a lot to say about kind of the mindset and how to maybe organize a team and replies and how you should handle things. Today, we're going to talk about a lot about the structure. I think the stuff that I've done, firsthand experience and the tools that we use to get the job done. And I think we're going to break this up into a couple areas. The first is email. email, because that's where a lot of your support's going to come through. The second, third, and fourth are going to be shorter. Talk about knowledge bases, live chat, and potentially phone/Skype if you wind up doing that. So to dive into email, it's interesting because years ago when I had just small info products and downloadable software, I was doing all support via Gmail. And I basically had a number of email addresses just piping into Gmail. And of course, you could then send as when you replied. And that actually worked. If you're one person doing support, it's not totally sustainable. It doesn't scale that well to not have tickets and not be able to make notes and all that stuff. But I think it's the best way to get started right off the bat. If you really have just a small, simple product and you just kind of want to do it, but you're going to want to transition out of that when you hit any type of scale and move into a system like a Help Scout or a Groove. From Gmail, there was no Help Scout and Groove when I transitioned, and I moved into Fogbugs, which I stayed with for many years. We used it for both issue tracking and for support. And frankly, we outgrew it and it became a little long in the tooth. They haven't updated it with a ton of new stuff. And so now we actually do use Help Scout and we really, really like it. So this is how we support my email marketing app, Drip. And Help Scout has a lot of advantages over other tools that I've used in the past. Basically, there are a ton of keyboard shortcuts that you can use, almost like the Gmail keyboard shortcuts. So you can do an A for reply all or an R for reply. You can add a note with N. You can set status using S. I mean, you can almost not use your mouse and use the app. So it's a lot faster than other tools I've used. The other cool thing is it has this email interface. So basically, when you get notified, if you pick something up on your phone that you got an issue assigned to you, you can reply directly to that issue, that email, right on your phone or frankly from Gmail, and the reply will go directly to the customer. Or if you put, there's some kind of fancy keywords you can add, so you can put at note, just the at sign and then note, you can attach a note to it, then reply again and put at assign and assign it to someone on your team. So it allows you to do stuff without ever having to log into a web app, which I found is hugely productive for me if I'm on the go. And then it's fast and there's a really nice plugin you can build. I think it took us like an hour or two, and we'll reference this a little later, but in essence, on the side of like Help Scout issues, we can see the customer and we see, you know, their like gravatar, and then we can see if they are paid or trialing, or if they're not a customer at all. We can see how many months they've paid, what plan they're on, and their past support ticket. So there's just a lot of value. I'm sure there's other systems that can do similar things, but we've really enjoyed using Help Scout for the past maybe 6 months. How about you, Mike? What tools have you used for support?
Well, I mean, kind of like you, I started out just using Gmail. And right now, I mean, I still run everything through Fogbugs. It's fast. It's easy to have everything kind of dumped all into one place. And I don't really have to worry about it. I mean, I don't get enough support tickets for most things anyway. I mean, I maybe get a handful a month. So it's not really worth going down the road of building this like full-blown support system in place. I mean, it's a manageable level, so I don't really worry too much about it.
Yeah, very cool. And then let's talk now about kind of these three stages that I've defined here. It's in essence, think about email support when you first launch as stage one, and then probably within 3 to 6 months, you want to get to stage two that we'll define in a second. And then after that, there's stage three. So stage one is the founder or founders are doing all the support. And this is really where you need to start, because at this point, you don't have enough information to be able to train anyone else to do support. And your contact with your customers early on is just invaluable, because you're going to be getting so much new information and so many new questions all the time that A, you're going to want to improve the product quickly. B, you're an upstart, so you want to be able to respond instantly. I mean, when we just launched Drip, I was responding to everything within, it was like 20, 30 minutes, just every ticket, you're just getting back to people. We were literally, we'd get a ticket and then we'd like build the feature or add the checkbox they needed and get back to them within 2 hours. And that's how you have to be in the early days, in my opinion, of running a SaaS app or running a software product, is super responsive, because that's one of your main advantages over one of these big companies, is just your speed of doing it and your knowledge. You know, since you're not like a frontline person at some big company, you can offer in-depth advice and you really know how your product works at this point. And so I think there's a lot of value in the founders doing email support for the first, like I said, let's say 3 to 6 months.
The other advantage of doing all of that support yourself early on is that you get a sense of where people are struggling with your product or service. So especially if you start seeing the same types of things over and over, it allows you to not only build some training collateral that you can hand off to somebody for tier one support later on, but it gives you an idea of where the hurdles are that people are running into. So you can either tweak the product itself or the service, or you can educate the person who's going to to be taking over the support later on, or you can just educate your users a little bit better in your onboarding material. So there's a bunch of different advantages to doing that support yourself up front. I see people trying to just take that and they say, oh, I don't want to do support. And they try to hand it off to somebody else. And that's really hard to do just because the fact is that, like, you need some of that information. It's harder to get it from somebody else than it is when you hear that stuff firsthand, because then you get this broad view that is unfiltered from those customers versus when you hear it through a support rep, because the blinders are on a little bit, so to speak. Not that they're hiding information, but they don't necessarily relay all of the correlations between the different conversations to you.
I totally agree. Having that direct line with your customers, it's big. And especially early on, you start to build relationships with folks and they learn to trust your app and to kind of trust you and think of the whole experience as being a good one. And you need to do that early on in your app's lifecycle because you're trying to build this brand in the early days.
Just what you said there about the entire experience, though, that also relates to how you're going to do business with them in the future. I think that's an important piece of this, is that when you're able to get back to them very quickly and you take care of them down the road, if they start running into problems, they're not just going to throw up their hands and walk away and go sign up for something else. They're going to come back and they're going to talk to you, especially if you're either not meeting their needs or if something goes wrong, they're going to be more willing to cut you a little bit of slack if things start to go wrong and maybe they're having problems with a support rep or maybe there's some things that are going on where it's just wrecking their productivity. They're going to be more willing to come back to you because you have done the right thing in the past than they are to just walk away and go find something else.
Right. And the other reason you want to do support in these early days is that you have no process yet. You don't have frequently asked questions. You may have made up a few and put them on your website, but you haven't received enough questions and had to think hard about the answers and created some canned responses and to know the struggles people are having to be able to train a support person. So in essence, if you did bring someone in this early on, you could say, all right, go play with the app and then answer the questions as best you can. Anything you can't answer, refer it to me. In essence, they would assign it to you, but you'd be getting a lot of stuff assigned to you. And at that point, I believe wholeheartedly in the value of just being on the front lines for all the other reasons we mentioned as well as this one. And then at a certain point, you're going to want to get to stage two, because as a founder, you can't be spending all of your time supporting the app and handling frontline support. You're going to be involved to some extent, but as the requests become a little more repetitive and you do start to develop a process and your canned responses and you're seeing the same questions over and over, you want to move into stage two, which, as I said, it tends to be about 90 days in. It depends on how fast you're scaling up. If you're still at 20 customers 90 days in, then maybe you don't need to move away from it. But if you hit 75, 100, 150 customers, you do need to start thinking about getting out of the support role. And here's what stage two involves. It's basically hiring someone to handle your tier one support. And by tier one, that's just your front lines. It's a person who answers every single email that comes in and either answers them or assigns it to the appropriate person. And at that point, the founder will probably handle all other issues. So at this point, you have all this knowledge, so you can create your docs, your training screencasts for the basic recurring issues. And then anything that your frontline person doesn't know how to handle, they can assign to you. And typically, what I was doing was then trying to train that tier one support person by not responding directly to the customer, but by giving the support person the knowledge so they could respond and either putting that into a Google Doc or just putting it in the reply so that that person is now trained on how to handle that issue moving forward. You know, there's a couple different types of these tier one support people. In the old days when, you know, I had some small info products and stuff, really didn't have much of a budget, I did hire like really low cost VAs, let's say $3 to $7 an hour, often in the Philippines or India, and they were handling stuff. As I've been able to level up and build apps that generate more revenue as well as require a higher level of support, I've been able to hire like a higher caliber, more knowledgeable, some people even with a little bit of technical skill, like help desk level skill, maybe not programmers, but people who know what FTP is and can explain things to folks. And if you get that second kind of person, you know, we have Andy doing drip support and Micropreneur Academy support and that kind of stuff. He is willing and able to learn new things and teach himself. And so when we did launch Drip, I'd been telling him about it and I was intending to create a bunch of docs for him. He said, just give me a login. I'm going to log in. I'll look through the KB that you have. I'm going to play around with it. And anything I need help with, I'll let you know. And that's obviously the best, kind of the highest caliber support person you're going to find. But you can certainly start out. I mean, many of us start out at a lower level where you really are just handing people kind of some canned responses. And even if they're just handling 50, 60, 70% of the support and others are still coming through to you, it's still a worthwhile investment until you're able to level up.
And that level of support person is going to take time to cultivate. I mean, you said yourself that he had started more on Hittail and then you kind of transitioned him over to drip. And by the time he got to that point, he just said, hey, just give me the stuff. That level of effort on his part is also partly a factor of how you have treated him as a contractor for you. So that translates over to that new product so that you don't have to train somebody from scratch. I mean, obviously there's training that needs to be done because it's a new product, but you don't have to train him how to behave towards the customers. You don't have to reset his expectations or set his expectations about how he should be answering questions. Like, all of that knowledge carries over. It's not the product knowledge, it's the how do you do business knowledge. And that's also very important.
I agree. And that's something else to communicate. We have a very kind of customer-centric approach to support, where we try to go out of our way and do everything we can to help them. And our refund policy is very liberal as well. And so folks want refunds, unless it's some crazy thing where they're asking for the last 6 months to be refunded. And every once in a while, we do get those. But other than that, it's like, when in doubt, lean towards doing what the customer is asking for and instilling that in the support person, and not just giving them, you can't give them the rules for everything. You know, at a certain point, there are judgment calls that need to be made. And if you don't want to be making those judgment calls every time, then you need to start instilling some, like you said, cultural things or strategies rather than just the tactics of how to respond to each individual ticket. So stage three of handling email support comes a little later. And I think this timeline depends on your growth, but it's definitely going to be when you start hitting multiple hundreds of customers. And this is when, as a founder, you don't even want to be handling all of the tier two stuff anymore. Basically, you're still going to have your tier one support person. Often they might be remote. They might work with you. The odds are they're going to be remote, because that's the way you're going to find somebody at a reasonable cost who is still high quality. And that tier one support person is going to, as I said, going to be doing the repetitive work, answering frequently asked questions, triaging things. And then tier two basically spiders out, right? Instead of it just being you, you kind of have five roles that I've defined. And a founder may need to handle more than one of these, but the five types of questions and support requests that we see coming through are developer-oriented ones, where they just get too technical for somebody who's not in the code to be able to answer. So that's the first kind. Second kind is like a consultation slash advice. And this could be pre-sales. It might be while they're trialing, or it might be when they're a customer. And this is when someone really needs help understanding concepts rather than how to use the specifics of your app. So I'll dive into that in a little bit. The third type is billing questions, asking for refunds, exceptions, that kind of stuff, that where someone doesn't want to make a monetary call. Your tier one person may not feel comfortable doing that. Your fourth is product questions, often feature requests, that kind of stuff. And then there's this other bucket that I've shoved a bunch of other stuff into, like partnership and such. So let's take a look quickly at number one, which is developer. And if you are the developer as the founder, then you will probably need to be this tier two role as well. With Drip, Derek and I launched it, and we pretty quickly realized that there's a portion of the tickets that come through that are just too technical, or they're too complex for a tier one support person, or even a non-technical founder, frankly. In the early days, this developer will obviously be a founder or a true developer, but we realized after we launched Drip that Derek was not going to be able to actually get anything done if he had to handle all the tickets that were coming through to this kind of developer support role. Because it winds up being, it can be a quarter or a third of a person's time in a given week, depending on how many customers you have. And so we hired someone as a developer slash support person. And so they do handle the tier two support. And if you've interacted with Ian at all in our support queue, that's who handles that.
Now I have a question for you about this. When you have Ian doing that, does he do any actual development too? Or is he just kind of a developer who is doing developer level support?
No, he is spending most of his time building features for the product. Like, he is a Rails developer. And then as support requests are escalated to him, he flips over and handles them. But that's actually less of his time is spent responding to support requests. But he does have that in-depth developer knowledge.
So I'm a little confused. It sounds like you basically hired somebody to shift the responsibility for the tickets off of Derek, but then this other person, they're spending most of their time doing development. I'm a little confused about how that works. I mean, because it sounds like you just shifted the problem from one person to another.
Right, right. Yeah, when I said Derek was not going to get anything done, it may be an exaggeration. He was spending a quarter to a third of his time responding to tickets. And so development, he's the lead developer. He handles everything that goes live, all the deployments. And so to constantly having him being pulled off in the middle of the day, he really was struggling to get the big features built. And so we did. So we hired someone else who is not the lead developer. He was kind of a junior when we hired him, and now he's worked up to a mid-level because he's worked with us over the past year plus. But then a quarter to a third of his time to be spent doing it, it's just a better use of time because Derek is focused on like the big meaty things, and we can move faster on all the pull requests Derek has to handle. And that's kind of his distraction.
Got it. So you're really just shifting where those interruptive requests end up.
Exactly.
Is really what it comes down to.
Yep.
Okay.
And overall, it makes us more efficient. We just get more done. And as we add other developers, then they, assuming your developers handling support requests can continue to handle those, then other people are freed up and they don't need to handle support requests, right? It's not like it round robins. I feel like that could spell trouble if you're interrupting a lot of developers all at once. And I also think that some developers are good at switching, and others, it's a lot more of a struggle for them. And we happen to have found somebody who's pretty good at it. And so I think that if you do find have a developer and he's struggling to do the switches, I'm not good at it, actually. When I used to write code, I had a real tough time switching into support mode. And so I quickly knew that it wasn't something I was going to be able to do. And so keep that in mind. It's not necessarily something everyone can do. All right. So our next type of tier two question is this consultation or advice. And so this almost comes down to like customer success, right? It's helping them be successful with your product, not necessarily about the nuts and bolts of it. But as an example, like with Hittail, we used to get questions about how should I do SEO? Does SEO work? Here's my site. What should, you know, do you have any advice for me? And with Drip, we often get, how should I structure my tags? Or what email marketing questions? What are my open rates reasonable? Am I doing something wrong? Right? So it's like architecture and marketing structure and advice and that type of stuff. And sometimes we will jump on a call if it's short and it's an easy question to answer. Other times we'll answer via email. I mean, we do have consultants that we refer people out to if we feel like it's a really exotic or just something where they need a lot of time to help. But being able to offer this kind of expertise quickly and give a few sentences of guidance, we found to be absolutely invaluable. And it sets you apart, again, from these larger companies. You email an AWeber or a Constant Contact, and they have tier one support, but they're not necessarily knowledgeable in like how to structure things. And so you don't expect them to kind of help you out on this front. And as a small company, this can be one of your competitive advantages, is being able to give very quick consultations or advice for free via support queue.
So early on, I assume that you were probably doing most of these in order to help offload the problem of the interruptive nature of those types of requests to Derek. What are you doing at this point? Is there somebody that you have dedicated to that type of thing right now?
Absolutely. Yep. I was doing that for the first 18 months, at least, maybe 2 years. And it was super helpful. And it helped me develop my knowledge of all the markets and how they work differently. And it expanded my knowledge of email marketing and marketing automation and all that kind of stuff with these different spaces that people are using Drip for. And then, yeah, about 6 months ago, we hired Anna, who is head of customer success. And she handles these now. And it's going really well, especially, you know, if people are trialing your product, they are basically wondering if it's going to work for them. And if they need help and you aren't able to give it to them, the odds are pretty high that they're not going to convert. And if you do help them, it's like you said, it's that early experience. They learn to trust you as an expert. And if your advice works out for them, then they become customers. I don't know that I'll say lifelong customers, but they become loyal customers because they know that you can help them out in the future if you run into this type of stuff. So I think this is probably overlooked in a lot of support queues or support structures, but being able to offer this is really quite valuable.
So the third one you have here is billing. How do you currently handle billing requests that end up getting escalated to tier two? I mean, I think that there's two different things to address here. One is the how you handle it versus how it can kind of generically be handled. So maybe we tackle those two things differently.
Sure. Yeah, billing is in essence, tier two stuff's pretty much passed up to me because often your tier one person won't feel comfortable making monetary decisions. And we've talked a little bit in the past, but I will often give tier one support the flexibility to make the decision up to a certain dollar amount. So you could say, you know, if it's going to be $50 or it's $100, no problem. You know, don't even bother me with it. And they may not make all of the decisions exactly like you would, but it's just not worth your time to handle 20 requests if they're going to make the same decision with 18 or 19 of them. It's just not worth it. And so then when billing stuff comes to me, then I have to make a decision. And oftentimes I'll involve other people on the team and get their opinion on how we should handle it. Because sometimes there's tricky ones of someone asking for a refund of a bunch of months or, you know, I don't know. There's just anomalies that come up where you kind of have to make a decision and there's no clear path.
Yeah, some of those, there's no right answer, and it depends more on what will make the other person happy without disrupting things too much internally, both in terms of your cash flow. And because the last thing you want to do is go back and refund like an entire year, especially if the person has been using it for at least part of that time. But yeah, there's always situations where somebody needs a refund for a very specific reason. And those tend to be more cut and dry versus the time where somebody asks for like a 6 month or a 12 month refund because things have been ongoing. And hopefully you knew about those to begin with, but there are those occasional times, there's those exceptions that come up where something was going seriously wrong and you had no idea, and now suddenly it's a big issue and a fiasco that you have to suddenly be dropped in the middle of without any knowledge of what was going on before.
or fourth category of tier two requests are really around the product. And these are mostly feature requests, maybe bug fixes, but really if it's a bug, the developers are typically just gonna jump on it. I think if it's a super low priority bug only impacting, you know, a small amount of people and it's not any type of showstopper, like let's say a misspelling, I don't know, something not catastrophic, then it's gonna go in the queue and they're gonna handle it. But it's feature requests that kind of need to be escalated because those always need prioritization, right? And so when feature requests come through, you want to figure out a bucket that you can put them in, and you can either assign them to kind of a made up person, if that's how you want to do it. For us in Help Scout, they get assigned to me and put into pending. And so there's kind of a big list of all these pending tickets that they don't show up as active that I need to respond to them. But every so often I go through and then I either make decisions of which ones to put into our issue tracker, which we use a code tree over GitHub issues, or I get the team's involvement and I'll often run through a bunch and make decisions and then ask the rest of the team based on what they've been hearing, because they're dealing with a lot of customers as well. And they might have a sense of the urgency of certain ones. And in an ideal world, when you get past a feature request, you'd have some context for it, because not all feature requests are created equal, right? I mean, it depends on, you know, if a customer is paying you $50 a month versus $1,500 a month, you may need to weight that feature request from the $1,500 a month customer higher. Or if it's someone that you know really knows the space and their advice is actually going to help your product grow, we've had a ton of those. You know, you get someone like a Brennan Dunn or Ruben Gomez using your product and they make a suggestion, it has a lot of weight to it because they know product and they know email marketing. And in terms of drip, right, that when they make suggestions, these are ones that I really listen to, because my guess is these are things that are actually going to be applicable to other people. So that's probably a whole other episode to record about how to prioritize feature requests. But I think the point here is when they come through support, you want to have a pretty systemized way to deal with them, because you are going to get a lot of them. We get several per day. And so you can't constantly be manually copying those into some Google Doc or into some other system. They do need to sit somewhere and you need to figure out a way to batch them. And then our last category of tier two support is just a kind of a miscellaneous or an other. And you're going to get these requests, especially as you grow, for partnerships, integrations. Someone's putting together a package for entrepreneurs or marketers and they want a discount code. They might need a sandbox or a test account. They want to interview someone. They want a quote for a blog post. I mean, there's just stuff that it just comes through. And what you'll find is that as you grow, you start getting more of certain kinds and you'll want to start either automating them or teaching tier one how to make the decision. And so the example of like, I need a sandbox or a test account, you're probably not going to build that from day one because it's quite a bit of time. And so over time, it's been escalated to tier two every time. And then I take a look at what they're doing and make a decision. But recently, we've realized that we're getting enough of these requests now that we are going to put something in place with a special URL we can provide for people to have a 90-day sandbox account that really just makes it a lot easier for us to handle. And it's not a manual process every time. And I think partnerships, any of these really could be done that way. You could automate to the point of, you know, you can send them a link to a specific form that goes into a Google spreadsheet and you could handle that in batches instead of handling each one individually. That's probably going to be worth it at some point for these kind of partnerships requests or interview requests or that type of stuff.
It seems like these other requests are the ones that tend to take the longest because you don't have a canned answer for them and you have to evaluate every single one of them, not only individually, but also in the context of the other requests that you've received in the past that were even remotely similar and try to maintain some sort of a consistent approach to them. But then in addition to that, you also have to take into account the growth of your app or your product and making sure that you are doing things in a way that's consistent with what your future plans are for it. So all of those things said, it makes it difficult in some cases just to even estimate how long it's going to take to address some of these, because some of them take a lot of back and forth as well.
And so moving on from email support, there's kind of three other categories that we'll cover pretty quickly here because it looks like we're running out of time, but kind of broke them down into like having a KB or some type of self-service support, perhaps using live chat, and then finally phone and Skype. So let's look at KBs really quickly. We were talking offline before we started recording, and I was mentioning of how surprised I am at how many people use our KB and how many people really do want self-serve, and they don't just want to send an email in. They either want the answer immediately or, you know, I don't know what it is. You had some other theories.
Mine was that because your audience is somewhat technical, they view their time as being valuable. And if they're working on a problem, they don't necessarily want to do the context switching of moving away to sending off an email to support, moving away, and then coming back 2 or 3 hours later, or however long it takes to get an answer that tells them exactly how to do it. And then they have to slot their time in to come back to whatever it is that they were working on. Essentially, they're in a time period where they say, hey, I've got an hour or two to work on this, and they just want to get it done and over with, as opposed to working on it a little bit and then having to set it down and walk away and then come back to it and do something else in the meantime. Because honestly, it's distracting to have to do that. So when you're in that situation, it's a lot easier and it feels better to say, okay, I'm just going to go through the dig through the docs a little bit to see if I can find the answer to this instead of just going straight to support.
Totally. And KB can be used in tandem with your email support. Obviously, we tend to try to answer questions directly and not just refer people off to KB articles, because I kind of hate that. If you email a big company and they just send you a KB link, oftentimes I'll find that's a massive article and I can't find my answer in there, or it's the wrong answer. And so if someone had just answered me like a human, then it would have worked out better. So we err heavily on the side of actually responding to someone. But it's only when they ask something like, how do I set up this integration? And we have like step by step that answers exactly what they want. Then we'll be like, hey, we created, you know, a KB and here's all the screenshots and everything, and link them over. So KBs are cool both for your own support team to be familiar with, as well as external customers. And in terms of setting up a KB, there's a bunch of options. I have a few that I recommend to people. HelpJuice, it's a shout out to Emil Hajrik. He has helpjuice.com, and I know some folks who use it and are happy with it. Desk and Zendesk, which I think if you're using them for support, they have KBs built in. I'm not a huge fan of having a KB built into your support software, because it's just one more reason that you can't switch away if you decide you don't like it. And then you can use what we do at Drip, which is just a WordPress plus a support theme. There's one called KnowHow. There's a bunch of others. If you search for it, you can do that. Now, then you have to work with WordPress and deal with its anomalies and themes breaking and that kind of stuff. So it's not nearly as easy to maintain as a SaaS approach like HelpJuice, but then, you know, you aren't paying the monthly fee and you can customize it as much as you want since you're in control. So let's talk about live chat really quickly. If you're going to use live chat for support, then you're going to want to put it in app only, right? If you put it on the outside of your, like on your marketing site, you're going to get a lot of sales questions. And that's a whole other discussion of whether or not you want to do that. But if you're going to use it for support, you put it in your app. And I would even consider only activating it for trial users if you can. That's something we're entertaining the idea of these days. We've done some in-app live chat stuff with Drip and have had mixed results in terms of how well it works. Oftentimes you just need time to research something, or you get a question and you need to talk to a developer, or you just can't answer everything. And so it's not actually the most efficient, even though it seems like it should be. But there's a number of solutions for this. Olark, Zopim. I've heard that Intercom's live chat that they've added is not actually live chat, or it's kind of like pings you, but it doesn't show if people are online. It doesn't work the way you think live chat should work. So I haven't used it personally, but I've heard kind of negative reviews about it. So Olark and Zopim are certainly the players that I've heard a lot about for this type of support.
Yeah, I've never used chat support before. I mean, inside Communifier, where we host the Micropreneur Academy, there is a chat system there, and I've used that to some extent, but it almost feels like there are much better solutions out there for chat. And a lot of things just come in through email. Some people just prefer email over the chat. So a chat is one where, unless you're there all the time, it can be difficult to do that. So I can definitely see where Intercom might fall down if it doesn't work the way people think a traditional chat system would work.
And lastly, talking about phone or Skype or something like that, I think if you're a single founder and you're just launching your product on the side, then this is not something you want to do. I tried it early on with .NET Invoice and it was incredibly time consuming. It also depends on the type of customers you're dealing with. Certain customers, you can jump on the phone, it's a piece of cake, and then others are just really tough to explain things to. And you're trying to explain what a screen looks like or how to click here, you can't give them screenshots. And if they're really non-technical, you can't get them to join a screen share to show them. So stuff can become pretty cumbersome and really kill a lot of your time. It's also interruptive if you're taking inbound calls. The successful companies I'm seeing do this on a smaller scale, you know, when you have a team of five or something, is to have you initiate the call. And you can either just give me your number, you can call them directly, or you could set up a Calendly thing and try to do something later in that day or the next day. Depends on how urgent the issue is, for sure. But sometimes it really is the best route. If you have a customer, there's certain customers you know and you trust, and you know that if they have an issue, that it's not some crazy thing that they're going to waste a bunch of time, that they really need help now. And sometimes it's just the best way to do it. And then other times, you know, you'll get a customer who you're not sure about, and you're a little concerned that maybe they're going to try to get you on the phone for 30 or 40 45 minutes. And those are the ones you have to kind of make a judgment call about when you do it. So if you want to do screen sharing, join.me is a decent example. Certainly if you have something like GoToMeeting and you're paying for that already, it's a no-brainer. We found that Skype has mixed results. Some people just don't use Skype, so they don't have a username. You have to add them and then they have to accept. You know, there's just more to it than that, but there are definitely options for doing this. And sometimes it just is the best option for handling more complex issues.
Yeah, in terms of tools, there's a bunch of different systems out there for screen sharing, and JoinMe is one. Another one, again, these tools and the specifics of the one that you choose is going to be heavily dependent upon how you need to interact with them. So whether it's you need to show your own screen or you need to share a screen and maybe control their screen, again, all those things factor into which tool you use. But as you said, JoinMe is one of them. Copilot from Fog Creek is another one. Then there's also WebEx and GoToMeeting. And both WebEx and GoToMeeting, on the surface, they look like you have to pay for them, but they both have free accounts that you can sign up for, which it's somewhat limited. I think on WebEx, you can get a free account and you're limited to 3 participants. But after the trial period is over, I don't think that you can request control of the other person's screen. I think up until that trial period's over, you can kind of hand off control. But once the trial period's over, you won't be able to do that. One of the things that we came up with just before the podcast episode was the idea of treating some of the people you're onboarding differently based on whether or not they're currently in a trial versus when they have been a customer for a long time. Because obviously those people who are just signing onto your service are going to have a much higher likelihood of churning if they are not familiar with who you are, what you're doing, and they're not ingrained in the product. So we discussed this a little bit. We don't really have any experience in there, but if anyone out there is listening to this and you have tried doing this before, we'd love to hear from you. Just send an email to us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. We'd love to hear your story of it, and we'll share it on the air with people. And I think that about wraps us up. If you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups, and visit startupsfortherestofus.com for full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.